With the neutron bomb, urban populations have lost their ultimate value as nuclear hostages and have been abandoned by military planners. There are no more immortals of the city, and cinema itself has lost its initiatory value and ceased to be the black mass of martial aboriginality, which can offer cinematic Valhalla to the children of the fatherland in a communion of the quick and the dead. For the commercial distribution of video and audio equipment is destroying the extraordinary technical capacity of the old cinema to shape society through vision, to turn 1,000 filmgoers into a single spectator.
The very rules of evil, of negativity and singularity, including the ultimate form of singularity, which is
podcast.
To the old state of things, in pure violence without object and form. This is the typical violence of information. It's violent because what happens there is a murder of the real, the vanishing point of reality.
Let's not have a misunderstanding here.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Machinic Unconscious Happy Hour with Cooper Cherry and Taylor Atkins. As always, sponsored by the People's Institute for Revolutionary Semiotics. Before we introduce today's discussion, we just want to mention, got that Patreon account at patreon.com/MUHH. Consider dropping us a dollar a month there. But if not, maybe leave us a nice review on iTunes and we'll give you a shout out on the following week's episode. But today, Taylor and I are back in the saddle and we'll be discussing Paul Virilio's book, War and Cinema.
War never changes. Sorry, it's a Fallout quote. Just ignore me. So I guess I would just ask, because I'm curious.
Sure.
How this title kind of caught your attention and made you suggest it for the pod?
Well, I feel like this is a direction that we've sort of been moving in a broad way, I think, toward, like, building towards Deleuze's cinema books and going through a lot of the monographs and so forth. You know, all the Kant groundwork we've done, even some of the, you know, stuff from like The Fold and whatnot. But, you know, this is the Hume, all of this sort of stuff, I think, plays into this kind of broader stream that we've been heading towards, I think. And so I thought it'd just be interesting to take a look at Virilio because we haven't really discussed him much. You know, I know he was friends with Deleuze personally, and is just kind of someone that is like this kind of maybe not even tertiary character amongst the kind of French post-structuralists, even though I think you had mentioned he's mentioned in the Fashionable Nonsense book from Sokal and Brickmont,
yes.
Right?
Brickmont. Yeah, they basically chide him for supposedly kind of playing fast and loose when speaking of speed and acceleration, mm-hmm. and kind of like perhaps speaking in a way as though to conflate the two. And I think that, you know, what Sokal and Brickmont, what the whole book shows over and over and over again is kind of this blue check literal mindedness of trying to look at discourses that are not proceeding like the exact sciences and hold them to standards of exactitude. So obviously, when you speak of speed and acceleration, if you conflate the two in physics, you're going to fuck up.
Right.
Right. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. When you speak abstractly in the sense of philosophy, because they're doing different things, they're laying out different, you know, philosophy is trying to lay out a plane of immanence. Science right. is working with the plane of reference. They're doing different things. When the scientist holds philosophy to its own standards, of course, philosophers are going to look like idiots. They already do a good enough job doing that by themselves, right? Like,
yeah,
that's their main critique of Virilio's, what is it, the speed of politics, or The Politics of Speed. I forget what the title is. I haven't looked at it in a while. But yeah, that he conflates speed and acceleration. One of their critiques of Deleuze is that he kind of uses a notion of chaos that's not scientific. Again, Deleuze would say, I am not proceeding like the exact sciences. I don't have an exact concept of chaos. We are working with an exact concept, right? Where we're taking a concept from another field outside of philosophy, and we're importing it into philosophy under certain determinations, under certain restrictions. So if you have this blue check mindset where everyone's got to play your own game and you just go around saying, actually, like, yeah, everyone's going to look like a fucking idiot, even more so than they normally do. And this is the shit that philosophy has always done with science too, though, is trying to say, well, science can't really actually think without philosophy, right? So this is the same kind of warfare that I've talked to you about before, that Laura Wells trying to, the non-philosophy is trying to solve. We're not here to talk about that today. I was trying to kind of like excuse Berilio and certain other thinkers from the SoCal and Briegmont critique, because, you know, it's just, it's not, it's continental philosophy, not continental science, right?
Like, good point, yeah.
That's just going to be my thing. I think that, you know, when the discourse is about science, you may want to have a little bit more exactitude and rigor.
Right.
When it's not about science, it really depends on what the concepts are doing and how they're being applied. You can't just take something out of context and be like, well, that's not scientific. And honestly, that's not even an interesting critique, but a lot of people got off on it. I mean, a lot of, as I said, a lot of people have paid for Twitter. So go figure.
Yeah. Right? Really not someone that you hear a great deal about, even in the kind of like accelerationist discourse, which, even though he's not like the Nick Land sort of, but he does he does trade within that, those waters of, or the idea of speed and acceleration as it pertains to, I don't know, history, communication.
Right.
To switch gears a little bit, I think it was just to give you, you know, you asked the question, like, why did I pick this book? And I want to say that it's, you know, we're speaking with Claire Colebrook next week about her book. Do you remember the title of that one offhand?
Who Would You Kill to Save the World?
Yeah. In which she talks about this, she doesn't say this, but I refer to it as like a cinematic ontology.
Yes. So, the cinematic is very crucial to her argument, which we'll be able to talk about next week.
But something she says that I think is germane to this discussion is her take is that Deleuze's interest in cinema is related to the way that it takes the perceptual apparatus beyond the human. Even interestingly, you know, Virilio talks about this in the sense of like, not only in this kind of dialectical relationship between the development of war machine, not to be metaphorical, but like the literal machinery of war, things like machine guns, and how that sort of the sort of co-development of things like cameras and so forth, chronographs, right? There's this whole back and forth dialectic between these two sort of forms of technology that are kind of go sort of hand in hand in the development of what, I don't know, what you would probably characterize as modern warfare in the sense of, you know, machine guns, sort of removing the human element out of warfare. So there's, I think, a little bit of a similarity there relative to the machinic processes of perception as it pertains to war, right? Because not only does this impact how war is carried out, right? Because you have things like reconnaissance, you know, you may have started out with like air balloons doing static photography over battlefields, etc. Very quickly, you can see how that a direct line from that to something like drones or spy planes, you know, in the 50s and 40s and so forth, flying at these, you know, elevations and so forth, and getting this perspective of the world that is singular, right? It's almost this totalizing imagery. There's something weird about this kind of singular perspective, but I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself there. But so that development and how that impacts warfare and kind of the historical development of film technology, which eventually does extend to the cosmos, which I think is quite fascinating, which Virilio points out.
Yeah, this kind of co-development of the cinematic and the, what's a good word for it? The belligerent, the bellicose, the art of war and the art of seeing and being seen. They share this kind of history and this co-development, obviously technologically, and that's one of the main vectors. But as you pointed out, there is, as we'll see with Claire, and we'll maybe talk more about that next week, there are ontological aspects to this as well.
Yeah.
That's not just technology, although that is the main vector through which this co-development can be, like, you know, seen. Because obviously technology makes what we have as cinema possible, but it's not, but there is a, like, a, what Claire talks about, Stiegler's arcade cinema, right? When he's looking at the Lascaux caves and shit. So to a certain extent, technology does not exhaust cinematic possibility, even though that may be the main vector of what we're going to talk about today.
I'll go ahead and read this little bit from the text, because this talks about, I think, a little bit of, this goes towards this notion of, like, extending the human perception into the machinic realm. 20 years later, at RCA's laboratories, Vladimir Zorkin invented the iconoscope, the first name for the electronic television. He presented it not as a mass medium, but as a way of expanding the range of human vision, indeed anticipating the Pioneer and Voyager space probes by many years. He even wanted to place a camera on a rocket to observe inaccessible regions. This urge to expand the range of vision and detection eventually found a scientific answer in the electromagnetic radar beam, which at the time of the Battle of Britain gave the air the transparency of ether. A lot of this too does go back to Kant and the Kantian cogito relative to adding time in the mix of things, right, in terms of thinking and perception, right?
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. Yeah, I guess I would also think of the way that space becomes, you know, what transforms from being, you know, from this ancient point of view to this, it's just the matrix of appearing, right? It's the phenomenal plane, if you will. It's the plane on which all objects or phenomena appear. And so in that sense, space becomes almost a kind of panoptical plane, if you will, as though if you could just attach a camera to the transcendental, right? You know,
yeah, right.
Space would be able to capture whichever part of it, you know, it's matrix. But yeah, you brought up time instead of space. I was just kind of thinking of the, obviously, you know, the inner sense and outer sense, right? So you brought up inner sense. I just talked about what Kant calls outer sense. So it is interesting to think of, obviously, the passing of time is the way in which, at least for Deleuze, Kant's subject takes on a dynamic unity.
I mean, but to even go to the, to bring these two together, I think would be the concept of, like, the close up in a certain way, or the wide shot, right? Because in terms of perspective, if we have a tight close up on an actor's face, right, there's something intimate about that. There's a, like, proximity to it. Proximity in the sense of, like, our sympathy, to go back to that discussion too, that a close up can really convey emotion in a way that a shot from far away may not. But let's even that aside, let's go back to, like, so the difference between, like, a close up and a wide shot. Like, let's say we have a crane shot of a cloud versus a crowd versus the close up of a particular individual, right? The way that time passes, or the duration maybe of the individual within the scene, like, let's say we're following a particular individual via close up or tracking shot or what have you, versus if we're taking a wider viewpoint and we're seeing the way that the entire scene unfolds. There's a different nature of time there, right? Between those two, the way things are perceived. Do you kind of get what I'm saying there?
I know Deleuze in the cinema books makes a whole fucking deal about the close-up on the face. He starts categorizing all these different images, one of them being the affect image, right? So there's something affective about the close-up. And it's, you don't see as much of it these days, or maybe it's not, it's the art of the close-up perhaps has changed, really, I would say.
Whenever you're viewing a film, is that something that you're like really paying attention to? Because due to continuity editing, you know what I mean? And especially in Hollywood film, unless there's like a more avant-garde editing style that tries to call attention or calls attention to itself by being outside of this attempt at providing a cohesive perceptual experience or affective experience. I don't know if that's because I definitely can. Since I have had a little bit more direct experience in the production right. side, there are times that I'll be taken out of the movie magic aspect of it. A lot of times this is in reverse shot sequences where two characters are dialoguing and the camera edits back and forth between perspectives. In those cases, oftentimes you can detect when it took place at a different time, let's say, where maybe both characters are not even necessarily in the same room, right? It could be a stand-in, etc.
I probably don't pay enough attention to it. Depends on the movie and why I'm watching.
To go back to this idea of speed too, because you thinking about in terms of warfare, the history of warfare, right? It's all about, you know, it's like this progression from a fist hitting another human's face. A rock might become a proxy for a fist, then a bullet becomes a proxy for a rock that develops into something like the Gatling gun or the Colt revolver. It's sort of hand cranked, right? The way that like an old camera would sort of have that hand crank mechanism, and the way that that maps onto something like the technological aspects of film, because the film, like even a singular shot, right? It shares the language of a gunshot, which is kind of very strange how that you wonder how does something like that become embedded within a totally different, you know what I mean, cinema and war. From a common sense point of view, you might not see the direct relationship that Virilio is talking about in this kind of dialectical way.
I mean, so much of Virilio's argument setting up this duality or this symmetry is, you know, how seeing the enemy is more or less in the modern wars that are being discussed is the prerequisite for killing them, for eliminating them. You know, you illuminate to eliminate, right? That's this kind of coherence between the two, or this consequential nature between the two, kind of makes sense from the very get-go. And I mean, some of the stuff is even like stuff that I'd never thought about, where he, towards the end of the book, you know, he's describing how from a horizontal plane, Germany's, I think this is like World War One, Germany's, or maybe it's World War II, war plan against France seems misguided, chaotic, or not to have any pattern. But from a vertical plane seen from above, you know, because he's talking about how you know, cameras are attached to these planes and stuff, but seen vertically, the German war plan starts to take on new meaning, starts to take shape and take order. So his point being that France was a little too late to accept this reality and kept looking at the pattern horizontally, right, instead of from above. So this kind of, even this notion of perspectivism, which you kind of brought up just a minute ago, but even almost as though we're thinking from the director's seat or something like this,
yes,
or from the cameraman's
yeah,
seat.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. I think that's a very important thing, is this kind of like omniscient eye or whatever, like this kind of panopticon. There's something about that that's like, I can't really quite even fully articulate the aspect of it, but it even goes to like my thoughts on Muad'Dib and prescient vision, right? Because he's almost like this omniscient director of the narrative of the universe in Galat. We can go back to that later. But I just wanted to kind of highlight, there's something about that, and that's an aspect of the cinematic ontology, like this voyeuristic point of view, this passive point of view that almost goes to something like anthropology. We observe these quote unquote primitive cultures from we're the alienated sort of audience who have lost something about some essence of our humanity that we try to regain in this passive jouissance of voyeurism. And that being kind of the guiding principle of the cinematic ontology. To apply that to war, you can see, you know, the human is removed in a sense in warfare. And something like World War One, where like they said, you know, you're using scopes and optics and you can't even really see the face of the enemy. So it's this like completely machinic, maybe not in the delay. I'm just using that very loosely, and you can correct me. Feel free to correct me or make a distinction if you want to. But you know what I mean? There's a whole different aspect of warfare where Virilio even talks about this as well, that means and ends become disentangled.
Interesting. Yeah. You said alienated, you could say dehumanized, you could say, machinic's not a bad way to put it. Obviously, it becomes accelerated and it's a different pace, it's a different scale. But yeah, I mean, so much of it, as you pointed out, is there's a different aspect of the fight where, you know, it's much less about two armies kind of like meeting in a field, right? Everything becomes, so to speak, subterranean and hidden, obfuscated. So, you know, we could see how the new role of searchlighting, spotlighting, illuminating, all of these techniques that are used for capturing cinema, right? I mean, this way of, as you pointed out earlier, you know, the camera shooting and the gun shooting, like their technologies kind of co-evolve in a similar space, even if their objectives are obviously different. But on the other hand, Virilio devotes at least a chapter to how, you know, generals and were, as I mentioned, trying to like put these cameras on planes in order to try to use that as ways of that kind of espionage, as ways of getting a view of the enemy, getting a view of their positions, their numbers, their sort of logistical routes. You know, in that sense too, the development and improvement of optical telemetry goes very much hand in hand with the possibilities of warfare and becomes one of its weapons, right? And then on the opposite side, there's obviously all of the not only the movies dramatizing warfare, but all the propaganda films put out, right? So that there is this kind of dual life that back and forth that Virilio tries to look at, right? Optics in war, but war in optics. He does it pretty well. So it's not just a parallel evolution. They are crisscrossing and intersecting and boosting one another.
There's multi-layers that this is operating on in terms of the propaganda film. And I don't know if Virilio necessarily is making this point, but maybe it's implied that, okay, so you might have, there are out and out like intentionally propagandic films. What's the one he brings up? The Lenny, what is it? Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will or whatever.
That sounds right.
The Nazi film Triumph of the Will, right? So obviously directly propagandistic, but I think there could be something, and this might go to Claire Colebrook's book, about there being something about the form of cinema itself, the cinematic ontology itself, that is propagandistic, if that makes sense. And it goes back as well to the whole discussion we've had thus far, back to that notion of proximity and extending our sympathies and so forth, and how that expresses itself. You know, let's say back in the days of the ancient Greeks in warfare, right? There may, if there were two Greek city states going to war, and let's say you may meet another Greek on the battlefield and you may kill them, right? There's a certain sympathy or that you would extend to another soldier that is different than shooting someone from a drone or like a sniper rifle 5,000, you know, a mile away or what have you, right? So this proximity element, hand-to-hand combat versus this voyeuristic thing, you're less likely to sympathize with something far away versus if you're right up in front of, even though the Greeks may have killed one another, like there was still an aspect of sort of respect or recognition of the humanity of your opponent, if that makes sense, versus now in these ways that warfare is carried out, that's totally removed out of the equation because you don't even see them. The pilots that dropped the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, right? They killed so many people, but they like, it's a whole different thing from dropping a bomb from 40,000 feet versus stabbing somebody face to face. That even goes back to that idea that I brought up about when we were, I forget which discussion it was, but talking about carrying out the execution, right? The executioner versus the person who passes the sentence should swing the sword, so to speak. And if you can't bring yourself to swing that sword, then perhaps that person doesn't deserve to die. Like, I think there's a certain place where that comes into this discussion of proximity and sympathy and warfare and killing and life and death and sort of this dehumanizing aspect of distance that allows us to discard our sympathy. And that goes to space, right?
I mean, it does. And it is a good question. This way of, you know, not only as you're pointing out this distance in space, but distance from the act itself.
This is where ends and means become disentangled, right? Kind of like in the Kantian ethics of modernity. And this is the way that it expresses itself in the material history of humanity through the technological advancement, right? Not only of cinema, but of warfare and so forth, and the coextensive development and blah, 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 right?
So this is why you have that quote, when time lags were lost in real time itself broke the constraints of chronology and become cinematic.
Now, what's interesting here, I think, is not to spoil too much of the Colebrook discussion, but I think one bone to pick with her I did have was she talked about the cinematic ontology, but I don't think she necessarily gave as much credence as I would to the historical foundations or like how long this has played a role within humanity, because I think the ancient Egyptians, and Virilio astutely makes this point that the Egyptians and their, like, I don't know, I want to call them frescoes in a certain way, or to maybe like misuse that in a way, the way that the hieroglyphics are displayed, or like the, you know what I mean, all the figures, there's like an implied sense of movement, almost in the way that you might consider like a comic book having an implied sense of motion, but just lacking the technology to portray the actual motion, right? So the ontology was there already and simply lacked the technological expression, but the Egyptians were already thinking in terms of motion. This may be a little bit galaxy-brained, but I also think, in a sense, they were also already thinking about extending human perception to the cosmos. Animation is produced by what the Egyptians called luminous vitality, an expression which shows how well they had mastered the anatomical problem of perception and the production of appearance, not as something given, but as an active operation of the mind, right? Okay, perceptual apparatus right there. Much later, Seurat rediscovered that with his divisionism, While Kandinsky and filmmakers like Gantz saw the first task is to speak to the eyes, in Egypt there was no symmetry, but only equivalences. Walls were walls of images, limestone strips painted from top to bottom on which figures passed in action. Once more, we are very close to the definition of chronophotography, successive images representing the different positions that a living being with a certain gait has occupied in space at a given moment. And then I can build on that quote with this next one. In essence, he once said, we create violence out of our memories and not out of what is directly presented to our vision. Just as in childhood, the viewer himself fills the blanks and his own head with pictures that he manufactures a posteriori. I guess that doesn't really build on the quote, but it does go to, I think, a little bit that notion of proximity relative to violence and war and sympathy.
Well, I can imagine the filling in the blanks, whether it be with memory or with sort of our own imagination, that having to do with the way that cinematography is able to play with images in a way that may seem unprecedented, but actually isn't.
I think this quote he, Virilio, has from, I'm not even familiar with this gentleman, but apparently he had some association to Lenin. Dziga Vertov, who joined Lenin's first agitprop train in 1918, had this to say about the filmmaker's armed eye. I am the camera's eye. I am the machine which shows you the world as I alone see it. Starting from today, I am forever free of human immobility. I am in perceptual movement. I approach and draw away from things. I crawl under them. I climb on them. I am on the head of a galloping horse. I burst at full speed into a crowd. I run before running soldiers. I throw myself down on my back. I rise up with the airplanes. I fall and I fly at one with the bodies falling or rising through the air. That quote is an excellent expression of an aspect of this kind of cinematic ontology pseudo concept that I'm coming up with.
Yeah, it nicely, it kind of nicely positions the director's eye poetically, right? It's the camera. It's a bit romantic, but on the other hand, it's a bit futurist the way that it describes it, right? This acceleration of possibility of capturing images.
Here's another quote from Apollinaire that I think is interesting to know. This would go to maybe something relative to machinic desire, or I don't know. That's perhaps a bit problematic, but I'll run this by you and see what you think. The sight of blind, non-directional desire, a kind of telescopic tensing towards an imagined encounter, a shaping of the partner come adversary before his bodily probable fragmentation.
Yeah, these quotes are pretty awesome, honestly.
As sight lost its direct quality and reeled out of phase, the soldier had the feeling of being not so much destroyed as derealized or dematerialized, any sensory point of reference suddenly vanishing in a surfeit of optical targets. Being constantly in the enemy's sights, he came to resemble Pirandello's cinema actors. So this brings together a lot of the threads that I've been trying to tie together here relative to the cinematic ontology. This kind of like falling under this director's, like you said, this one sort of perspective, this omniscient perspective of the director, in a kind of tie into almost like the panopticon idea. The way that he finishes here, being constantly in the enemy's sights, he came to resemble these cinema actors. He goes on to say that Renoir shows that even outside the field of battle, which never actually appears in the film, war subverts the proper experience of sex and death.
Is there a proper way to experience sex and death? And how are we subverting it? That is like,
I guess it would go to like that machinic thesis.
Yeah.
Because of an intimacy, or like, I don't know, there being as well something about the distance that cinematic distance, the sort of voyeur, like being in the crowd watching the spectacle, just like the being in the crowd at the Colosseum between two gladiators. That distance does something to our perception, and film really gets at that because of the idea of, like I said earlier, the close-up versus the wide-angle shot of the crowd. Like, that's a, there's something about distance and emotion and sympathy, but also, I guess, the decontextualized nature of the spectacle.
Yeah. The context of this is interesting, right? Where he's talking about Renoir's The Grand Illusion, and, you know, he's going into describing the movie, but he says a general interpretation mania is imposed by the very facts of military logistics, for the soldier receives in his mail packet the bare outlines of a meal rather than a meal itself, a lock of hair, but not a real head of woman's hair, right? So you're getting kind of just the, almost like the vapors, or the, you're getting not the thing itself, just a kind of good sign of the thing.
Excellent. Right. Excellent. Yeah.
So
yeah,
you're only getting the sign of sex, or the sign of life, or the sign of death,
which
the
lends
semblance of it, but not the thing.
Which very well lends itself to the way that cinema operates in terms of, like, again,
yes.
The close up, which would be the more specific close up type is the cutaway. So the example of the cutaway is where you may display a character's face, and then you sort of would go follow his gaze, and then he would maybe look down at his wristwatch, for example, right? And so then the wristwatch becomes this fragmented aspect of this totality, and the way that editing works is it creates this continuity out of all these discontinuous perceptions into this sort of perceived unity that's illusory, right? Like this quote he has from, this is about the camera obscura. Pastrone showed that the camera's function was less to produce images than to manipulate and falsify dimensions. And here Virilio is kind of talking about the way things change when you're talking about from painting to even still photography to even then on to cinema. It kind of accelerates that false dimensionality to further this. What was false in cinema was no longer the effect of accelerated perspective, which I kind of was just talking, right? But the very depth itself, the temporal distance of the projected space, this relativity in which speed appears as the primal magnitude of the image and thus the source of its depth. The temporal distance of projected space.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of idea being put together here.
What does it mean to falsify dimensions, you know?
Good point.
From the standpoint of photography or cinematography, right, you can play with proportion. This is done in a lot of film miniatures, right? You can, because the perspective, you can play with that. You can, and that would go to the Kantian sort of idea that you were talking about, the thing, it's our perception of the thing and the thing in itself and that distance. Because a film like Blade Runner used plenty of fucking miniatures. You would never sort of be able to perceive that unless you're, you know, just unless you either knew or were extremely perceptive.
Yeah, and this notion of falsification is interesting, right? Because in the context of war, this may matter in terms of determining certain trajectories, determining certain, again, in terms of telemetrics, if it comes down to the science of war, then yes, the falsity of cinema would matter. But on the other hand, with what we're talking about, with what you brought up, your examples of the miniatures and these kind of things, now we're talking about the powers of the false. And now we're talking about the false in cinema is actually one of its powers.
Yeah.
And not something about, it's not something deceiving the eye in any simple way.
Right.
In the same way that Trompe de l'Oeil is like a function of painting to trick the eye. That's, if life and death hung on the painting's veracity and verisimilitude, then we could talk about falsity in a kind of classical way. But instead, it's about delighting the eye. It's the same with cinema, right? So outside of the context of war and logistics, the falsity of cinema takes on a totally different meaning.
It's interesting, too, you just mentioned logistics. To go back to our discussion about, I guess, distance and proximity, but also like the way that before we had cameras and so forth, like typically, it's hard to point to a historical period specifically that I would use it as an example, right? But we can say that at some point, the generals would sort of lead from the rear, right? They can view the battlefield on that horizontal plane. And that kind of is very similar to the way a director might mobilize a film production. They're observing from afar. They're using optical, different optics to, you know, at some point the binoculars were used for warfare, etc. You know, you can very easily see how that would apply to films. I'm glad you brought up the Towers of the False, because this was something I was thinking about too, because there's an interesting way that Virilio kind of touches on ideas from Deleuze and Baudrillard in a way. Most notably for this text would be, you know, I can think you can almost feel like Baudrillard read this. There's very much the spirit of the Gulf War did not take place. Kind of that's sort of the sort of implicated here or implied here throughout the whole book from Virilio. Is there something about, you know, because he even talks about the way that some of the soldiers experience these battles in these very fragmented ways. But it also goes to this notion of the false and images and the simulacrum and Plato and how Deleuze kind of inverts Plato in this way, right? It would be like, okay, so these cinematic images are, you know, they're degraded images of the true world, right?
Right.
Versus the powers of the...
Well, they're not being held against some kind of standard of reality that would be based on resemblance. Once resemblance is no longer the criterion for judging difference, then, you know, obviously, along with that recognition, analogy, opposition, blah, blah, blah. But resemblance is one of those things, one of those key kind of phrases that Plato makes. The, you know, if the heaven of ideas is up here and those are where the real things are, and then down here, we just have reflections that resemble them. And then the painter paints a resemblance of the thing that merely resembles the idea. So it's a second degree.
Right.
And so that's, so if cinema takes that and is able somehow demonically to capture this without even any handiwork, artisanal craftsmanship by an artist, but it's mere technological, like demonic possession of the thing, you know, you can imagine the language that Plato might use to speak about cinema in the very way that you see in the Republic, in the sort of allegory of the cave, which basically has a cinematic backdrop, if you want to talk about it, right? It's more or less contemplating cinematic techne as spectacle, as falsehood, as the falsehood of reality.
Yeah.
The falsehood of becoming, one might say. Right, the falsehood of actual real life, you know, which is why I think Nietzsche denounces Socrates and Plato in the end, right? Nietzsche's like, you know, Socrates couldn't die fast enough. He was happy to take that poison. He was ready to go to his heaven of ideas, right? That's, but once resemblance is no longer the criterion for difference, then the sort of what the crowned anarchy, the unleashing of the simulacra, of the cinematic duplicities or duplicitousness that can run wild and not be held against some kind of criterion of verisimilitude.
Yeah. In Colebrook's book, she kind of says this thing that you kind of described from coming from Plato as this demon. This is an aspect of cinema that Deleuze kind of finds fascinating. Decentering the human relative to the apparatus of perception. And I don't know, that even might go to my point about the way that, I mean, the powers of the fall certainly do, in the way that I was talking about just the formalism or the form of cinema alone is a type of propaganda. And I suppose that propaganda is a technology, maybe, is a communication technology that could be wielded for good or ill. There's a certain agnosticism towards, I guess it's retreating to a point of like, okay, we're sort of stuck in this perceptual arrangement, this sort of perceptual form. We're not going to be able to ascertain the things in themselves anyway. So let's retreat to this point. I mean, maybe that's more Kant than what Deleuze would say, but so we're going to retreat to this point and say, okay, we know that this is a falsity, but we don't have any choice but to work with the false. So let's mobilize the false to our benefit. I don't know if that jives.
I think it does. I think the language surrounding false, the only reason why this language of powers of the false persists is because of a long history of thought that spans way beyond Plato and whatnot, but definitely encompasses centuries of Christianity and Christian thinking. This is the reason why we have to kind of speak in this way about the powers of the false, rather than to reorient categories that are merely affirmative. It's still kind of rooted in the everyday commonsensical thinking about, you know, this Platonic Christian worldview about things as they appear being sort of fallen, in the same way that humans are fallen from grace, right? Everything is in the state of perpetual fallenness. And this is why we have to like try to root for the what's supposedly the bad guy, right? This is why, you know, the false is the anti-hero of the story, of our story.
To link this back to Virilio more directly, he kind of talks about how, I think he talks about how this was even acknowledged by Churchill, like the spiritual nature of terror, about that being more powerful than even the weaponry itself. If you could create that sense of terror in the enemy, that has a greater power than the thing in itself, to be a little bit cheeky, right? Like the weapon itself, the threat of atomic destruction becomes more terrifying in terms of battle or as a deterrence. There's something more terrifying about the anticipation of destruction, the anxiety of complete annihilation. The submarine, like the Titanic submarine that was crushed. I was reading a post or article the other day, and it was like the speed at which they were killed was so fast that it exceeded the brain's ability to cognize it. So they didn't even know they died, because it was something like 0.9, the brain would take 0.93 milliseconds to process this. Well, they were already totally destroyed at like 0.5 milliseconds or something like that.
Interesting.
There's some interesting aspects of the cinema too, because I want to say that it's the movie The Great Train Robbery, where it was either that or like this movie where there's like the bank robber like shoots at the screen, and like before people were like habituated to the cinematic, people were freaked the fuck out. Like it caused people were terrified by this image of this cowboy like shooting at the screen. But I might have to link this in the show notes so people can know what the fuck I'm talking about. 1903. Silent film by Edward S. Porter for the Edison Manufacturing Company follows a gang of outlaws. This is what I'm talking about. Yeah, so it is this film. And then if you think about this and extend this out to something like the way that people enjoy horror movies, or you know what I mean? I think maybe that's an aspect of this too. about this sort of formalistic terror.
Why horror? I mean, there is a way of, like a lot of these movies, but horror in particular, you know, there's a way of becoming uncomfortable and feeling, allowing oneself to feel the ability to be scared while in the comfort of one's own home, right? So you get to be, you have the comfort of being uncomfortable, right? You have the comfortable of feeling, you have the comfort of feeling terror.
Like I said, extending from the Colosseum in Rome, right? Just intensified by this like machinic aspect. So there's kind of that voyeuristic, cinematic, ontological aspect of it that goes to maybe the, I want to say maybe to the death drive, like, not that it's, I mean, maybe it's too simplistic to say that like it's this proxy for experiencing death. Maybe there's something to the drive, like to that aspect of something about us wanting to live beyond even the like self-preservative drive. Maybe that would be the way to think about something like horror or this.
Right.
Am I making sense there at all?
Yeah, I see where you're pointing towards. Yeah. It's the undead in life or whatever.
You want to experience this maximal intensity of death. There's a jouissance in that.
Right.
There's something about us that wants to experience the libidinal intensity of death without necessarily dying.
Or even the threat of it.
Right, right, exactly.
You're tapping into at least the semblance of that enjoyment that you're talking about.
He has a really interesting quote from Napoleon about the capacity for war is the capacity for movement.
That was a good one. Yeah, I remember that. And it makes sense. I mean, this is stuff that when Deleuze and Guattari cite Virilio in A Thousand Plateaus, so often they're pulling from, you know, his way of thinking the fleet in being, or showing how the fleet in being is, he applies this to his analysis of territory, right? The sort of the territory, quote unquote, ownership is, it's not, it's owned by those who traverse it and work it and move through it. It's not, ownership is not, you know, relegated to a mere dominance or even settlement, right? It's really about movement. And that's what they kind of look at with created space and smooth space. But I'll just skip all that stuff. But basically, the fleet in being is kind of looking at the way in which maritime ships occupy space by moving through it constantly, right? And circulating through it. So I think that in that sense, Napoleon's statement is, you know, very much true, right? That war is about movement. And this is why I think that became more and more and more true as technology developed, which is why I think the Blitzkrieg was so terrifyingly successful, right? Ways in right. which formations, statical formations, became much less, became much more a thing of the past, right? With being able to redeploy, you know, in ways in which had never been done before, gave a tactical advantage, right? So yeah, I think Napoleon's right, obviously. And
that still goes to, I think, this kind of Kantian aspect of the thing and the thing in itself, and terror, like the terror being more impactful than the actual thing. Because it's not necessarily the size of the force, it's the speed of the force.
Right.
If you look at a bullet that's like in your hand, right? If you're holding a bullet, not threatening, the thing there in itself is no threat to you. But if that motherfucker's coming at you at 1,000 feet per second, then, you know, you're dead, right? Kind of interesting. Yeah. The same thing, but traveling at a different speed can be go from harmless to deadly.
Right.
It's quite interesting.
The gun representing the propulsive force behind the bullet is what's scary. The bullet itself never really appears as such until
you feel its effects, but you don't really see it. Yeah.
Right. That's the thing. It's the, we're afraid of the gun, not the quote unquote bullet per se.
How interesting is that to go back to that, the end of the great train robbery to like,
yeah, pointing at the camera's optical gun, right? It's the camera's rifle.
Did I already read this quote? Because I thought this was pretty interesting too. He says, Gantz's definition of the cinema was close to that of War Machine with its fatal autonomy, magical spellbinding, capable of giving the audience in every fraction of a second that strange sensation of four-dimensional omnipresence canceling time and space. This kind of autonomy of the War Machine extending beyond the human, that's similar to the point out, you know, I even said this very thing about that has that connection to the machinic for Deleuze. Like that's what he finds fascinating about the cinema, is extending the human perceptual apparatus in this way.
Yeah.
That is not directly human. And like we said, up to the cosmos, whenever it comes to like these probes and satellites that we send into outer space, it's pretty fascinating. Right. Because if then it cancels time and space for us, because how long would it take us to travel? How long would it take us to travel to, you know, Jupiter or blah, 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 and come back? Which also goes interestingly to like light itself. You know, we were talking about light, and Verlio does as well, how lighting, not only in the arc lights, spotlights within the context of war, but also within cinema, right? It's like the lights are what makes things perceivable. So there's kind of an interesting relationship to light, but also something like the way that, for example, it takes light from the sun 8 minutes to reach us on the earth, which would again go to Kant. The light that we see from the sun isn't even immediate light. It's light that had already left. This whole discussion, this collapsing of space-time, is super interesting there. Even goes to the character of Muad'Dib again, because he can sort of collapse time and space into these points, right? He's the one, the shortening of the way, the shortening of the space. That's what Kwisatz Haderach means, the one who shortens the way, I believe.
Might be a cool place to stop.
What we can wrap on up on is this, because I think this goes along with, I think, the tenor of this idea of the cinematic ontology, because this is advanced through devices. So let me read this from the text. Those American TV channels which broadcast news footage around the clock without script or comment have understood this point very well, because in fact, this isn't really news footage any longer, but the raw material of vision, the most trustworthy kind possible. The extraordinary commercialization of audiovisual technology is responding to the same demand, for videos and Walkmans are reality and appearance in kit form. We use them not to watch films or listen to music, but to add vision and soundtracks to make us directors of our own reality. Now, if you think about this in the context of like your iPhone, right? You can take your iPhone out on your hike, for example, and then you have a full-on basically soundtrack. And I mean, I even think this way whenever I'm hiking. My vision, I can kind of choose, like I'm the director of this film. Like I can decide what to focus on, etc. There's something added with the audio aspect of it that gives it this cinematic context.
We're all walking around with a cell phone in our pocket, so we're all little cameramen, little cinema photographers, potentially at least.
But yeah, I don't know. That really kind of hammers home what I think the essence of the kind of cinematic ontology is about.
Which we'll get to talk about more next week with Claire Colebrook.
But yeah, I suppose if you didn't have anything else, we can wrap up there.
I mean, a lot of what I wanted to say has to do with Claire's book, but we hit some of the highlights, you know, and I think that this book of Virilio seems to be building off of some of the earlier work, and almost so it almost has less of a theory vibe that we normally go for, and much more of a kind of calm historicizing contextualization of this optics and warfare.
Right. Yeah. He does go through a lot of the history, which I kind of sped read through a lot of that and just pulled out kind of the more, the juiciest, the
theoretical
notes.
Nuggets.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So we got to savor those mostly, but the, you know, it's a pretty decent and pretty quick read going through and seeing the way he draws upon the history. If the listener is interested, I recommend looking at it. Good read on a Sunday afternoon.
The discussion of D.W. Griffith really was really interesting, the historical aspect of that, and him like going to try to make a movie or like propaganda film out of World War One, but it's this very static thing because you have the trenches and like no man's land, and there's like not a lot of movement going on. There's less drama as well, because even if you're like a sniper or you're something like that within that context, it's much different than like a cavalry charge or like two units of warriors, let's say like a phalanx versus blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Where it's more intimate and there's more face-to-face action versus this almost slowed down, ironically, aspect of modern warfare, where it's a lot more like sitting around than action-based. The cinematic ontology angle of it is totally different. We'll be back next week with Claire Colebrook, and we'll probably be touching on some of this stuff more thoroughly in that investigation. So look for that, and we'll see y'all next week. Thanks for joining us on this week's edition of the Machine Gun Contest Happy Hour.
The very rules of eating, of negativity and singularity, including the ultimate form of singularity, which is the world state of things, the pure violence without object. This is the typical violence of information. It's violent because what happens there is a murder of the real, the vanishing point of reality.
Let's not have a misunderstanding here.
With nothing left but recycled, whitewashed, lobotomized people, as in Blockwork Orange.